for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. healthcare costs have been climbing for years, outpacing inflation and the growth in national income. But the trajectory is unsustainable. Joining me to talk about what's driving healthcare costs, what needs to change, Daniel Callahan. He's president emeritus of the Hastings Center. Karen Ignani of the American Association of Health Plans and the Health Insurance Association of America. Joining us from a studio in Portland, Maine, Dr. John Winberg of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy. We do invite your comments, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Good to have you with us. John Winberg, Dr. Winberg, if I could start with you. A great deal of capital is expended on the cost of health care. What is driving these costs?
Well, looking at it over time, it seems to me that the most important driver is the continual increase in resources devoted to health care, the numbers of doctors we train and put into practice, the number of hospital beds we build, particularly intensive care units, and the new technologies, and indeed the old technologies, which keep creeping in, and we're using them at greater intervals.
Both old and new technologies continue to bolster costs involved in health care.
Right. But I think understanding the dynamics of the market, we learn an awful lot by looking at the variation that's occurring in a given period of time across different parts of the United States, where we see huge differences in the amount of money spent on a per capita basis, striking differences in how much care is actually delivered, particularly to patients with chronic illness.
Why is that? Why should geography have such an impact?
It has a lot to do with the underlying differences in the supply of resources, particularly when it comes to treating chronically ill patients. Just to give you an example, Medicare now spends upwards of $10,400 a year in Los Angeles, but only $7,200 per year in places like Portland and Seattle. And most of this money goes for the intensity with which chronically ill patients are treated, how many visits they make to doctors, how many times they're hospitalized, how many times or days they spent in the intensive care unit, how many MRIs they get. And this varies to an extraordinary extent between regions and can be traced back to the capacity of the system. Unfortunately, the capacity is generally used in situations where we really don't understand the relative value of, you know, one level of treatment versus another.
Karen Ignani, what do you see as the trends in the healthcare costs? What's doing the driving?
I think the trends are crushing for the economy, Diane. I think it's a very important show here to talk about the underlying drivers, and I think Jack did a great job of starting off the conversation. Just to add to what he said in response to your question, I think we need to step back in our society and migrate from a system that had heretofore been oriented toward catastrophic intervention to much more chronic and preventive care. We know people are living longer. That's a positive thing. The goal should be to improve their quality of life. That means getting them into the healthcare system at the earliest possible stage, but not through this prism or window of catastrophic delivery. And Jack made an important observation where you see wide variation in care and costs across the country. we're beginning to understand now in Los Angeles, for example, he appropriately mentioned the difference between Los Angeles and Portland, but we know that there's a deficit in primary care in Los Angeles, and that may explain why people are migrating to specialists rather than primary care physicians. So we need to think about supply issues. Jack mentioned that. I think that's exactly right. There are a number of primary care physicians that could use nurses to do a number of things in their offices. They want them to do that. The nurses want to do that. But there are regulations that are barriers to that. So this whole migration is important, I think, to chronic care and prevention and early intervention. I also think that Jack's probably I think he should take credit, let me put it that way, for the sounding of the alarm on the variation that we have across the country. And what we know from the literature, and we see in our health plans now are working with physicians and giving them incentives to follow best practices, what the physician specialty societies have determined the right way to think about patients. This isn't one size fits all, but how do we take advantage of efficiency and effectiveness to make sure that people get the right care at the right time? And I think that more attention needs to be put there. We've seen that in children's cancer very, very productively because there are relatively few practitioners, clinicians treating children with cancer. It's harder when we get to more practitioners, but there's been so much work done on this concept of getting the information in the hands of practicing physicians. We've been doing a number of things across the country in the health plan community to support physicians with this kind of information.
Karen Ignani, she's president and CEO of the American Association of Health Plans and the Health Insurance Association of America. John Wenberg is the author of a new book. It's titled Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare. John Wenberg is both an MD and an MPH. He's Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. And turning to you now, Dr. Callahan, how do you see the growth in the cost of medical care?
Well, I first of all say I agree with Dr. Wenberg. He certainly has got the major features of American healthcare, at least the way we deliver healthcare. Karen certainly points out the importance of making a move toward prevention in that direction. But I had a somewhat different angle. I believe behind our problems ultimately is our belief in medical progress and constant innovation. Our American medicine basically has declared war on death. The National Institutes of Health does not say we're out for immortality, but if something kills you, they're after it, and they say, give us more money and we'll cure it. Well, the fact of the matter, we're not finding a cure for the major chronic diseases. What we're finding is very expensive ways to keep chronically ill people alive for a longer period of time. That's why there's such heavy costs at the end there. And secondly, I would add, I spent a lot of time in Europe in recent years, and as messed up as our healthcare system is, there's no country in the world, developed country, that you go to that is not having a healthcare cost problem of one kind or another. A lesser problem because they manage it by virtue of universal healthcare, but basically they have the same underlying pressures, namely aging populations, technological innovation, and very high expectations. So I see this as a fundamental problem, the way we conceptualize the whole goals of medicine. So when we talk about prevention and the like, we really have to say prevention will only really work if we stopping some of the expensive stuff at the end of life. Otherwise, we'll have a wonderful, healthy life, and then we'll spend a zillion dollars in the last few days.
So. It's interesting to me that as we're doing this program, the drug Avastin has been taken off the market. Talk about that drug.
Well, once a week there seems to be an announcement of a brand new, quote, breakthrough drug, exciting, so forth and so on, which turns out to be enormously expensive. Avastin is the last case. And this is a classic example now. One of the important developments in recent years has been really trying to, how do we find what's effective medicine, what works and does not work? The FDA, basically their committee, has decided this is not a good drug to use. It's got bad side effects. But nonetheless, you have a public backlash. At least many patients have a backlash. And people hate the idea of rationing, but the point is very expensive for a very short term of life, and that's exactly the kind of thing we can't stand in the long run.
Dr. Wenberg, do you see Avastin as an example of rationing?
Well, it actually isn't perhaps the best case we have because it looks like it doesn't work. So if we define rationing as withholding something that's of value, in this case, I don't think it applies. The problem of rationing is always underlying the question about practice variations, but the thing I would like to point out is that some of our most prestigious academic medical centers practice a very conservative brand of medicine that is compatible with a gross national product investment of much less than we're now doing. I'm talking here about the Mayo Clinic, for example, in the University of Wisconsin. And if you compare their practice patterns to, say, NYU or UCLA, which are also very well and high prestige academic medical centers, we see that in NYU, 35% patients and 38% of patients at UCLA actually die in the intensive care compared to only 16%, 20% at Mayo Clinic and the University of Wisconsin. So big differences in the way end-of-life care is managed from one place to the other in the United States by highly prestigious institutions. I think this underscores the weaknesses in the scientific basis of medicine, that here these very famous academic medical centers should practice medicine so differently. And that, I think, Dan Callahan's point is really, really right on.
Dr. John Wenberg, he's founding director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He's author of a book titled Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare. Of course, I'll look forward to hearing your calls, questions. Stay with us. And as we talk about rising healthcare costs in this country, but not only in this country, around the world, one of the issues that you, Karen Ignani, want to raise is malpractice.
Right. I think it's I think one could step back and say it's really an example of a failure to move forward and resolve an issue that needs to be resolved. And from a physician perspective and a hospital perspective, I think rather than focusing on the issue of tort reform, which has been the subject of most of the discussion around malpractice, we should step back and talk about what each of the guests are talking about here, which is if you want to incentivize best practice, then protect physicians and hospitals if they're practicing best practice. So in a malpractice situation, give them legal protection if they're following guidelines that have been established by the physician practice associations, the cardiologists, for example, the orthopedists, et cetera. That seems to me a possible breakthrough here that would align a strategy and with what we know to be the problem.
Dr. Callahan, how do you see that?
Well, I think that's very important. My own sense is malpractice is a problem, certainly hovers over the head of many physicians, and I think it's probably true some of them worry about it and alter their practice accordingly. At the same time, I think it's important to keep in mind that that's the, they're trained to worry about, trained to use technologies. Patients want the technologies. Companies make lots of money off of it. You have all sorts of things working together. So I think the question is to empower physicians, first of all, would help an awful lot. On the other hand, you've got to change the way physicians think about, at least many think about, the delivery of healthcare and what they're up to.
Dr. Wenberg, is it true that the more physicians there are in a particular region, the more likely people are to see a doctor and undergo a procedure or a test?
Oh, for sure. Physicians, you know, generally work full time. And if you have twice as many physicians in one region on a per capita basis than in another, you get twice as many, much medical work done. And it turns out that the kind of medical work you get depends on the kind of physicians that are in that region. So if you have more medical specialists, you get more hospitalizations and more diagnostic tests. If you have more surgeons, you tend to get more surgery. Mm. Although, interestingly enough, the type of surgery you get is not predicted by the supply of, say, orthopedic surgeons. That's another complication of the problem that probably should maybe take up on another occasion. But the supply factor is very interesting. It actually operates on sort of a subliminal level. People are not aware of it. For example, the physician visits are highly correlated on a per capita basis with the number of physicians who do those visits, like cardiologists and so forth. And the way they basically, the way the market works, the behavior that we're undercovering is that it's simply the interval between revisits that accounts for where that extra capacity goes. So in other words, it's not even recognized by the physician that they're doing this, and certainly there's no evidence, objective evidence in clinical science that ever tells you what the appropriate interval between revisits is. So this supply effect tends to work its way through without basically understanding what the implications are.
And for you, Karen, as president and CEO of America's Insurance Plans, tell me what the cost differences are between government programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurers.
It depends on the patient, because what you have in on both sides, both in public and private, you have about 3% of the patients consuming 50% of the resources. And I think that's why Diane, just stepping back, thinking about a need to reorient the system, that means creating and attending to the supply deficiencies we have in terms of preventive care, of physicians that are practicing preventive care, internists and family physicians. We need to be encouraging the development of more and the training of more of those. We need to be rethinking how we're using nurses, because if people are going from specialist to specialist, they don't have a guide, a navigator through the system. That's this whole concept of coordinated care, which is now, it was used in the 90s. It's now coming back in terms of thinking about what are the resources, what's our role in the health plan community, how can we encourage physicians to practice primary care, reward them for doing so. So we have developed medical homes and a range of new strategies, and then incent and encourage patients to be compliant with their disease regimens and to get their prescriptions filled, so that those who have chronic conditions aren't, you know, waiting to the point where they have a catastrophe on their hands.
And the problem right now, Dr. Callahan, seems to be that more and more medical students want to go into those specialties because they come out of medical school with huge debts and want to pay it off with those specialties.
That's certain. There's a lot of evidence that that's the case. But I'm also struck by the fact that there's a new generation coming along that does not want to live the kind of hectic life that earlier generation of primary care physicians lives. And I had a recent student intern from the Yale Medical School just graduating, and he said, also he added, he said, no, a lot of my colleagues think it's basically boring medicine too. They would, the specialties are more intellectually interesting and stimulating. And I found, so you've got a lot of things working there. Now, the money will certainly help matters an awful lot. On the other hand, it is a very hard life. The physician, the really good primary care physician, is on call around the clock, and a lot of young people don't want to live that way anymore.
Well, how can we provide incentives, Dr. Wenberg, to develop those kinds of primary care physicians?
Well, I think we might want to begin by looking at some parts of the country where that kind of medicine is not practiced. The Mayo Clinic, for example, is a paragon of organized care where primary care is practiced in teams and where the individual cowboy doc out taking care of everything all the time, that model is basically no longer around. And so a lot of it's how do we actually deploy the physicians that we have and how do we train them? One of the abiding problems, and I think this is along the same lines that Dan Callahan was just mentioning, is that it's essentially up to the academic medical center about, first of all, how many physicians of what specialty are going to be trained and in what environment are they going to be trained in. For example, the intensity of care at NYU and UCLA is so much greater than it is at the Mayo Clinic that physicians training in those systems are going to come up with very different models of how healthcare should be practiced. Mm-hmm. And my belief is that we need to look carefully at our workforce policy because, remember, fundamentally, the subsidies that are going into postgraduate training of medical physicians is coming directly from the federal government. So how they pay for and what they buy in terms of the workforce has long-term consequences for costs in the United States.
Dr. Callahan, you wrote recently about what you see as the misguided approach to end-of-life care. What are some of your concerns about that?
Well, I'm not sure misguided. Let's put it this way. I think end-of-life is care for some of the reasons I've already mentioned. Namely, we have a healthcare system which does not want people to die, trains physicians not to let them die, and the industry and the media train patients not to want to die. So not to mention human nature, same thing. So the question is, how do you deal with this complexity at the same time? And I think it's enormously difficult for physicians and families, even if they have living wills, first of all, to get more people to have living wills, but still complications arise in great part. When do you invoke the living will? The physician says, yes, we know you have a living will, but we think there's still one more round of chemotherapy that's worth a try. There's a lot of that borderline stuff that goes on. I think the problem has to be moved back a little more to not when people are dying, but when they're in critical illnesses, which are leading downhill. They're likely to die, but not necessarily
chronic
going
illnesses.
To die. It's chronic illness, but back a few steps. That's where we've got to start rethinking this, not just wait till the last minute and then suddenly switch to hospice. The problem now, people go in hospice much too late, average of 7 days before. They should be a month or two, but doctors don't like to tell patients about hospice because that means they're going to die. And families don't want to hear the message. A lot of patients don't want to hear the message. So you've got a lot of things. There's just denial of death is very powerful in our society, and that's what we have to overcome. Plus, we have to have different physicians who are quite prepared to tell patients how lousy life is going to be if we give you that extra round of chemotherapy, and that a lot aren't willing to do that. And then we've got to educate the public, too. The public puts pressure on physicians to do it. Again and again, I have physicians say, I get talked into it by my patients. So I don't want to do it, but I can't say no, and they're so unhappy, and it's not worth the struggle, and so forth and so on.
And Dr. Wenberg, you talked earlier about procedures, and I wonder how much the increase in healthcare costs are linked to those new procedures without measures in place to actually gauge their cost effectiveness.
I think that to really get at the fuller intent of your question here, I think we have to look at all procedures, not just new ones, because what we see, for example, is, if I remember right, 40% increase over the last 10 years in the rate of knee replacements, although knee replacements have been around for a long time. So this secular trend in care intensity is costing a lot of money. Now, if new procedures are also adding the additional complexity of being novel, often not really well evaluated, and sometimes become spectacularly kind of exposed, like some of the problems that we've seen recently with knee replacements or with hip replacements technologies changing that actually end up hurting patients. But I want to say that the dynamics that determine the variation in surgical procedure rates are different than the dynamics that cover the use of chronic care for chronically ill patients. They have much more to do with seeking an improvement in quality of life and making a decision for which there's significant trade-offs. Surgical treatment is not without problems, without risk, and many other treatments are much more conservative treatments are preferred by patients when they're actually involved in the decision process. So this whole idea of getting the patient involved actively in the decision process is critical to rationalizing, first of all, the variations, but secondly, what the real demand is for care. And the studies that I know of that have looked at the question of what proportion of patients who meet objective evidence-based criteria of need actually want the procedure that they're offered when they're allowed to make a shared decision-making. We see, for example, only about 22% of patients with certain forms of prostate disease actually wanted active surgery once they knew what the trade-offs were between sexual function and urinary tract function.
Dr. John Wenberg, he's founding director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice and author of Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Karen Ignani, I know you wanted to add to that.
I wanted to add the point, Diana, that I think we're talking quite a lot about the use side of the challenge. We haven't really talked that much about the pricing side. And the latest data indicate that 2/3 of the year-over-year increase in healthcare costs is now attributable to unit cost increase pricing. What are the charges for services? I think there's a triangle of opportunity here. I think creating incentives on the pricing side and on the use side to practice efficiently and effectively for providers.
But how do you create that on the price side?
I'm going to talk about that. That's one side of the triangle. The second is the point about creating incentives for individuals to do what they need to do as early as possible on the use side as well. And then on our side and the health plan side, creating these reimbursement incentives to do that. Now, in the area of prevention, we've pioneered medical homes with practitioners, primary care practitioners, to encourage them to do care management and really focus on chronic illness, where we're spending the bulk of our money and our resources. That will reorient the system. At the same time, Martha Coakley, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, just issued her second report, second year, looking at Massachusetts as a great example of wide variation in pricing in Massachusetts, no attributable value in terms of quality associated with the higher pricing. And we need to, and that's largely because facilities in Massachusetts have consolidated and are charging higher prices because they can. So we need to look at that part of the equation as well. And that's why I think the reimbursement systems and opportunities here, coupled with how do you think about clinicians, how do you think about hospitals, how do you reward them for best practice, how do we get more integrated health care, and how do we encourage patients to do what they need to do, but within their power? We shouldn't be penalizing them for things they cannot do.
All right. I want to open the phones now first to Rich in South Bend, Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, we were talking about, your last guest there was talking about pricing, and one of your panelists earlier was speaking about when medical industry saw a problem that they'd go after it full bore to try and find a resolution to it. My question is, why can't we set up a system where the pricing from the insurance companies, pricing from the medical industry is locked in with the rate of inflation, so that way people can still afford this stuff instead of having their 20, 30, 40, and 50% increases year after year.
It's an interesting point, Dr. Callahan.
The answer is because this is the United States of America. We don't like price controls. We hate price controls. The European countries use them very effectively and successfully and manage to get away with it with the industry. And I'm sure the industry mutters a lot over there, but we get away with it. But here we've resisted it, and it seems to be one way or the other, we have to eventually have price controls. I see no other way to manage costs. I think all of the incentives would be the sort of the long-term way to go around the problem, and it may work. But on the other hand, we may eventually be forced to have price controls and openly, but that's going to take a huge political and cultural shift.
Daniel Callahan, he's senior research scholar, president emeritus of the Hastings Center, author of Taming the Beloved Beast, How Medical Technology Costs Are Destroying Our Healthcare System. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Fareed Zakaria, host of the CNN program GPS and editor-at-large for Time magazine. He's revised and expanded his book, The Post-American World. He says it's not about the decline of America, but rather about the rise of everyone else. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back talking about the increases in healthcare costs, where they're coming from, why they are occurring. The last point that Dr. Callahan made was in regard to price controls, which in this country we seem to have avoided rather successfully. Let's go to Skinny Atlas, New York. Marguerite, you're on the air.
Good morning. My comment is my son is a nurse in Syracuse, and he tells me his hospital is full of patients that weigh 300 pounds or more.
And, of course, that creates a huge problem for costs, I would think, Marguerite.
They have all kinds of health-related issues related to obesity, and we only see this obesity epidemic growing.
Exactly. Karen Ignani.
I think Marguerite is right, and nurses have really sounded the alarm here on this problem, and I think they deserve a great deal of credit for it. I think the research, Diane, indicates that People do very well with diabetes management, prescriptions, and so on. We know that that makes a great deal of difference in people's quality of life. But if they reduce their weight, it makes so much more difference. And what we've tried to do in the health plan community is the alternative to price controls is to negotiate fees with physicians, primary care physicians in the context of medical homes, giving them a financial incentive to work with patients to get them to reduce their weight. We've incented them through Weight Watcher programs, which had very, very good results there. On the specialty side, giving people financial incentives to bundle payments for hips, for knees, things of that sort. So we're not paying on a piece rate basis, and that's much more efficient, much more effective. But Marguerite's right. This is a national emergency
exactly.
we have, and we have to have a broader conversation about it, and people have to understand what they can do themselves
precisely.
To improve their health. And that's in a partnership with their physicians and nurses.
And, of course, Dr. Wenberg, that obesity problem is expanding, if you will, to children. What is the percentage of childhood obesity at this point?
I simply don't have the statistic, on my fingertips here, but it certainly is increasing. I do want to point out what I think is an important point here, though, is that while obesity is increasing, it's not the explanation for the increase in overall hospitalizations. If we look at Syracuse, for example, is a very low-cost area with very low admission rates, even though it may have a lot of people now who are obese. But so also are there a lot of people obese in New York City and UCLA and the Mayo Clinic area. So the variation itself is not explained by that. And the overall growth in chronic illnesses, you've got to be careful about that because an awful lot of the so-called epidemic in chronic illness, and I'm not talking here specifically about obesity, but about diabetes and heart failure and other things, has to do with how many diagnostic tests we're giving to patients, how much we're patrolling and surveilling the population. And we clearly see in our data that regions that have lots of doctor visits and lots of highly intensive care end up actually having more diagnoses, even though the people don't seem to be any different in their fundamental underlying illness.
Dr. Callahan.
Let me just add one point. I recently got interested in the problem of stigmatizing the obese. And I got interested in great part because we stigmatized smoking very successfully. Not only we started with laws, but now you can't smoke out on many beaches, even though there's no, you're not going to harm anybody. And we've made it sort of morally disgusting to smoke. Now, the question is, to me, this is a real dilemma. Would we want to go in that direction with obesity? People who work with the obese know that they're discriminated against. It hurts their job. All sorts of things in their life are hurt by their obesity because people don't like obese people for the most part. So the question is, the stigma may work, but it may also at the same time be rather horrible for the people, although, in fact, it's effective.
Do you believe that stigma could work?
Well, I think it already has worked with affluent, well-educated people. Most of us do not get obese. It's very simple. Found out early in life that you're not supposed to get exceedingly overweight. You don't find many politicians in New York who weigh 300 pounds or in the Capitol, I would imagine. So it's already effectively, it's been one of those things you're just not supposed to do. And the question is, can we, I find it a real moral dilemma, actually, because
interesting.
Discrimination comes from stigma, and that's not good.
I think we also need to talk about, if we're talking about obesity, the issue of food and the pricing of food and what people can buy. I think we need to think about food stamps, Diane, and what food stamps are allowed to purchase and not. How do we get fresh foods and fruits into the inner cities? We know we have a problem. One of the points that Jack always makes is the difference between Oregon and L.A. or Portland and L.A. Well, in Los Angeles, we know in the inner city, people don't have primary care. They don't have access to fresh foods and vegetables, and they can't afford fish. So we need to step back and say, well, how do we deal with this broadly? It's not just a healthcare conversation or question, but we need to think about the farm bill. We need to think about food stamps. We need to think about access broadly, not only to the medical care system, but to fruits and vegetables so that people can actually afford to purchase the foods that they need to live healthier lives as well.
And one of the plans on the table is that of Congressman Ryan. And I wonder whether his plan for Medicare would actually lower health care costs or, in your views, would shift much of the cost from government to the patients themselves. Karen Ignani.
The $64,000 question is whether or not, in the context of the debt limit, whether the members of Congress on a bipartisan basis will begin to talk about the future of Medicare. And that's what you're getting to. And as we talk about the future of Medicare, which has been very interesting to look at the various bipartisan commissions, they have begun to think about strategies that could be followed that give people choices that begin to provide incentives for the healthcare system and clinicians to integrate healthcare, to practice best practice. So I think, Diane, we're at the beginning of this discussion, not at the end. And I think that we have no place necessarily, unfortunately, in the healthcare system or in the political system to step back and have these broad discussions of how do you make sure we can continue the promise that's been made to individuals, at the same time deal with the affordability crisis and make sure that people have the access they need.
Dr. Wenberg, how do you see it?
Well, I think the idea of getting skin in the game, which is kind of what Congressman Ryan's idea is a two-edged kind of problem here. Basically, in situations where patient preferences are really important to making a good decision, having identifiable differences in terms of the cost of care for people who prefer more expensive treatments, say, for example, back surgery as opposed to more conservative management, that there we definitely could consider introducing differential copayments that would rationalize healthcare, because if people have to share in the cost, they're going to think more about whether it's really useful for them. But when it comes down to the management of chronically ill patients, particularly towards the end of life, the last 2 years, 2-3 years of life, where most of the costs are, getting cost sharing in that situation as a basic driver of promoting efficiency really means it has to buck the whole supply variation that we're seeing. And it seems to me that it's a very risky strategy. So some combination of regulating the overall size of the market or the capacity of the market and some market-oriented things to help with the variations in discretionary procedures might be worth a debate.
Dr. Callahan.
Well, I think Dr. Wenberg might confirm this. I think there's pretty good evidence that if you raise copayments, for instance, an awful lot of people will cut their drugs in half, will not take them as often, or will not get prescriptions, refill things.
Even
if they need them, and this will hurt in the long run. So that to me is part of the two-edged sword. It's good that they have this incentives, but the point is, my own belief as a patient myself is we're not terribly good judges about what's really good for us or not in the long run in terms of what when we go to a physician or what kind of care we should want. So that's a real drawback to
but
that.
But can Medicare survive without? Go ahead.
Without
an increase in taxes?
No, not at all. It seems to me we need a combination of increase in taxes and a cut in benefits, not one or the other.
Both.
And I think this country can well afford it. Tax rates are actually at a historical low point compared to historically
so
speaking.
So how would you cut Medicare benefits and still be able to deliver the health care needs to especially the elderly?
Well, I have in mind a kind of triangle in my head, if you will. At the bottom of the triangle is prevention. Next level up is primary care and emergency care, hospital care, all the way to high-tech cost, which is where you get the chronic illness. And my idea is that we, first of all, have to make it harder to get that high-tech cost at the end of life, at the top of the pyramid, and keep pushing things to lower and lower levels. Some of this could be done by financial incentives, but a great part of it might have to be done by policy and saying there are certain things you cannot get the $100,000 drug treatment that will only give you a second live life. Medicare will not pay for that sort of thing.
So what you're saying is that too many of the elderly on Medicare are going for the high-end treatments that they otherwise could not afford if they were paying for it themselves.
I wouldn't put it in terms of going for it. I think they're more or less pushed into it.
By physicians,
by families, by their own instincts, by the media, the hyping of technology. I mean, we're raised to think we should get a lot of that care at the end of life. That's what we most need it. After all, we're dying. But somehow, that's somehow the wrong psychology.
Karen Ignani, that's just that. Yeah, triangle you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. And I think we could start the lower end. We know we have a problem in Medicare, Diane, that's been much documented about readmissions, for example. There's no point paying for readmissions, people who are going to the hospital and then have to go back because they have problems based on what happened in the first instance. We know in the Medicare Advantage program, that's the private sector part of Medicare, where 11 million people are in the program, we're doing a much better job on readmissions because we're investing in discharge planning, making sure people understand what they need to do when they get out of the hospital, who they need to go to. We're doing a better job on encouraging infection control and things of that sort. So you can start at the lower end here. It sounds simple, but it's not simplistic. And these are strategies that can, in fact, make a big difference and mean that beneficiaries don't necessarily have to lose benefits, which is the objective here. Not to lose benefits.
Karen Ignani, she's president and chief executive officer of America's Health Insurance Plans, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Lakshmi in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have a comment. I'm a fairly healthy person, so it was very heartening for me to hear one of your guests tell how much they would love for the patients to be engaged in the decision-making process, because I am very much engaged in every decision I take with my doctor. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, I've been very healthy, no issues. Went to my doctor 3 months ago with muscular pain in my right arm. I have a 3-year-old toddler. The doctor immediately said, I was hoping for a muscular relaxant or tell me something else. Instead, I was made to go for a chest CT, and then it went on from there to one specialist to another, and nobody was looking at my arm pain. Instead, like one of your speakers said, if you were to run diagnostic tests, you come up with something. You see a shadow on the adrenal gland. You run an MRI. Then they say, oh, there's nothing there. Let's go on from there. So it went on, and we have run up a bill for the insurance about $8,000, and my out-of-pocket is about $800. So I am pretty much at this point very frustrated because they came up with nothing except that I'm very healthy and I don't need to do anything. And as regards to my pain in the arm, they just told me, you have to live with it. I am so flabbergasted.
Because, of course, in a third world country
where they just tell you, okay, pray that your arm pain goes away on its own.
John Weinberg, do you want to comment?
Well, I really much agree with this caller. It's terribly frustrating, and this cascade of things that happen when you go in with an ordinary problem, particularly in some parts of the country, just lead to this expanding the diseases that people have, expanding the cost, obviously, and basically leads us to a blind alley. And that is kind of the microsystem examples of what we've been talking about, all of this belief in technology, all of this idea that we've got to find disease down to the last jot and tittle, because if we don't find it, maybe something's going to happen in the long run that we missed. So these are the problems that we face directly. Again, let me come back to say that according to the data that we've looked at, particularly the practice patterns among organized systems of care like the Mayo Clinic and the University of Wisconsin, We just don't see that happening. We don't see this this churning of visits. We don't see people getting referred to many, many different specialists. Primary care docs take care of most of this, and they do it through the common sense dialogue with patients about, what is this pain in the arm anyway? We've got to work on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act, Karen Ignani, does include provisions to bring down health care costs generally.
I think that the Affordable Health Care Act could have done more in the area of health care costs, and I think that's one of the reasons that we're still having the conversation. Similarly, in Massachusetts, I think politically, Diane, I think people had the view that it was easier to focus on the access and then do costs, but the system is being, individuals and purchasers are being crushed and the economy is being crushed. So we have to come back and really do much more here and have this conversation about how are all the stakeholders going to work together to address this problem, which is the key to the answer.
Karen Ignani, President and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans. Dr. John Wentberg, he's founding director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, author of Tracking Medicine, and Daniel Callahan, President Emeritus of the Hastings Center, author of Taming the Beloved Beast. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rain.